Hi, everybody. I know I haven't posted any new episodes in about a month, and I apologize for that. But today you'll be hearing from Dr. Judy Davidson, who is the lead nurse scientist at UCSD. And to do a quick introduction, my name is Danica Chen. I'm a fourth-year nursing major at SDSU. I started Beyond the Bedside to learn more about careers for nurses outside of direct patient care. And so thank you for listening, and let's get into it.
Could you tell everyone who you are and a little bit about yourself, just what you do, for how long, you know, stuff like that.
So thanks, Danica, for inviting me to talk today. Judy Davidson, DNP. I have a fellowship in the Academy of Nursing, so FAAN after my name. And MCCM, a master's in critical care medicine. I was a fellow in the Academy of Critical Care Medicine. I was the 35th nurse to become a fellow in this medical society and the third nurse to receive the master's title. It's just kind of like when you've got enough under your belt, it's like that you made significant changes in the profession. So that's my title, and then my certifications, and then I work as a nurse scientist for the University of California, San Diego, and in the Department of Nursing, the Division of Nursing, and through that role, help nurses with project development, presentation, and publication. Over the years, I spent since 1990 as a clinical nurse specialist, and my education for that was from San Diego State. My daughter always said that when I teach, I should let people know that I'm more than just a talking head and give them a little background about me as a human. So I grew up in Connecticut, moved to California back in the early 80s. When I first graduated from school, I took my first nursing job here in California, first in LA and then down to San Diego. And I met my husband when I was working at Sharp Memorial. I was his preceptor. Ooh. And he was becoming an ICU nurse. So we've been married for 34 years, and I'm married into a blended family. I have two older stepchildren that we raised together as a team, as a blended family. And I have one daughter of my own making, and we've had a series of animals and pets over the years. The children are all grown now and have their own lives. And I do have a multi-generational house again. Thankfully, the house was too big and empty, and I invited my oldest to come back and live with me with her partner and my grandson. So I live in a multi-generational home, and I find that quite rewarding. So I've worked in California, actually San Diego, as a nurse since 82, and I actually have friends from nursing from way back then. I attended San Diego State for my master's degree, graduated in 1990 as a CNS. And then I received the Monty Award from San Diego State in 2010, which is a Distinguished Alumni Award for Division of Health and Human Services out of San Diego State. And I think it leads back to my work with research, really, that I've conducted research since in a steady stream of small projects since 1985. So I've always had research ongoing since that time. I've never had even a moment where I haven't been conducting a study. And I did it under, with like what I say in air quotes, without a license, because at first I was bachelor's prepared. And usually you think of scientists as being these PhD prepared nurses. And then I received my master's degree. At that time, way back then, you had to conduct research for your thesis and you had to do a thesis. There was no choice of comping out, right? So I did a physiologic study under great mentorship by Dr. Barbara Regal at before I even went to grad school, looking at, I had a couple of different studies I did when I was still bachelor's prepared just to see, did I have what it would take to go to grad school, right? Because I knew that the thesis was a requirement. And then Dr. Lorraine Fitzsimmons was my, and Dr. Ann Vertiber were my advisors on my committee for my thesis and when I was at San Diego State many, many years ago. And I did a physiologic study about whether or not you could draw clean coeds off of the heparinized line, either through an A-line or a venous sheath in the groin, because those were commonly used back then, but not now, for heart cath patients. And we used to stick them for their PTTs because the lines had heparin in it. And I was able to demonstrate if you drew back the right amount of blood on an arterial catheter that had heparin infusing in it, that you could get a clean sample and didn't have to stick the patient. So in any case, since then, I've always had an idea in my head of something that made me curious in the workplace, and then conducted a study based on that curiosity, mostly with no money, almost no money down. I'm usually just curious, put together a research plan, get it approved by the IRB, conduct the study myself in my off time. I'm not paid by anybody to do it at work because I was usually a CNS or practicing clinician. And then for most of those years, just kind of did a little extra work on the side to answer my little curious questions. So, so that's how life progressed for many years. I became a CNS, did work a lot of studies as a CNS. I developed the very first NERSC protocol for using peripheral nerve stimulation to guide neuromuscular blocking agents way back in the late 80s. So before that, nurses would titrate the drugs by body weight, things like decurodium, pancurodium, the drugs that immobilize the body. And in the operating room, they were using these nerve stimulators to guide the dosing. And I wondered why they did it differently than us. And that's how the research questions start. Like, why do they do it different than we do? Same drugs, why? And we're infusing them, they're infusing them. Why don't we use this device to do it? So we adapted what they were doing in the operating room for the ICU setting. I had a mentor at that time that was an anesthesiologist, developed that first protocol. It became quite the thing, traveled all over the country, teaching nurses how to do it. I was asked to help write a national standard through the Society of Critical Care Medicine at that point in time at the chapter about nerve monitoring to accompany a national guideline on sedation and neuromuscular blockade. And that was like 91, 92, somewhere around there. And just kept going from there on, you know, with research studies ever since on a variety of different topics. Then you're probably wondering about like, what is a nurse scientist, right? Like what is even this job?
Because yes, exactly.
How did I get there, right? So I worked in community hospitals most of my career, but not all. From 90 to 96, I worked at UCSD, which isn't really a nursing teaching academic center. There's no school of nursing there. It's a medical teaching environment. There's a school of medicine, a school of pharmacy, but not a school of nursing. And then I worked all over San Diego over time as I developed my skills and moved into a variety of different positions, from clinical nurse to clinical nurse specialist to nurse manager. And then I became, had this really fun job where I was the clinical nurse specialist for the chief nurse officer at Mercy. And she just let me do all kinds of wild projects to help advance practice. Then when I received my Doctor of Nursing Practice from Case Western Reserve, she gave me the opportunity to be the director over the CNSs at Mercy. So all of the advanced practice nurses there reported to me for a period of time. And I just loved that job, being a leader of leaders. You couldn't ask for anything better, right? And during the whole time, I was still conducting my own research along the way, asking little questions and answering them through clinical research projects that had immediate applicability at the bedside. And then Scripps Corporate pulled me into a position, because I was like one of the only nurses conducting research at that time, pulled me into a position where I was overseeing all, in any Scripps facility, any research done by employees, people that were not physicians, and had to create and oversee a process by which those projects would get approved. And at one point, they decided that was all developed. They didn't need me to oversee it anymore. So I got laid off and then I moved to, which isn't bad because layoffs sometimes bring you to new opportunities. I went to UCSD, returned there, and hired into a job to replace my successor, Caroline Brown, who medically retired. And I replaced her as nurse scientist. So what that job is not to conduct research, but to help nurses conduct research, or to help nurses with practice change projects. So you spend your whole work week answering nurses' questions about how to set up a project that might bring in a new practice or improve a practice, or help nurses design their first research study and get it approved through the IRB. When they're done with their projects, I help them with writing abstracts and submitting them to national conferences so they can present their work elsewhere. And then also help nurses with their the publication process, help to disseminate their work through scholarly publication. So it's a really fun job. I'm like a full-time coach and mentor. And on the side,
it seems like you're more leaning towards education and mentorship. How do you like that compared to your previous role as the actual researcher?
Well, I do both. So I fit in my own research on the side, and then it's also considered part of my job if I have a clinical nurse on my research team that's never conducted research, then I'm teaching them the research process, and then we'll attack a question together and write together, present together, and do that. In fact, all of the students that I take at the graduate level, I offer them the opportunity to participate on one of my research teams, and they often publish right with me after a semester of enjoyment together, having fun together. So the last four students I've had, four in a row, we published papers together.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, you've kind of answered what made you decide on your role as the, nurse, scientist, and researcher.
I didn't kind of decide on it. It fell into my lap. Right? Like when Dr. Brown retired, I got phone calls from several people at UCSD saying, oh, you would love this job. And that's how it went. So I said, okay, I'll apply. And I did love the job. So it was like, it was just meant to be. So if you think about it, in scientists that work in the academic environment have a whole different set of constraints around their practice. Mm-hmm. So they usually are dependent upon grant funding to do their work, and they have to bring in money to the university to show their productivity and maintain their status in the ranks of scientists. And to get grants, you have to have background data and be an expert at something, and then follow that same train of thought for many years, because you have to show that you were good at it, that you can deserve this money to do more and better, right? And mm-hmm. So you develop a niche expertise and then stick with that for probably the bulk of your career. And shifting it is dangerous, because if you shift, then you've got to start all the way from the beginning again, collecting baseline data that will show people that give you grants that you've got the wherewithal to do it, right? So mm-hmm. to get a grant, you have to have a research team with experience in collecting data regarding whatever topic it is, and you have to have an expertise, a demonstrated expertise in this topic. Whereas I just follow my nose. I just find a research question, something that's curious to me, and I go off with it. And nobody stops me, because I'm not asking them for money, and I'm not going off after money, and I'm just like conducting it with a group of volunteers, students or other interested parties, and getting the work done. So there is a limit to the type of research I can do, given that I've never done a randomized controlled trial, you know, and those are the cream of the crop of quantitative research. But I've been able to bounce around on ideas. I first started, as I told you, with the physiologic things when I was knee deep in critical care. And then I moved, as I got older, into more issues related to family-centered care, developed a mid-range theory that's now used in many hospital organizations and tested by others to reduce stress and post-intensive care syndrome in families. Then after my about 10 or 12 years focusing on the family response to critical illness, I stumbled into this work I'm doing now with suicide amongst clinicians. Three nurses that I worked with at UCSD died in 1 year from suicide. And I thought to myself, huh, this is really curious. I wonder how much of this goes on. And I started studying about it and realized nobody in the United States had really put a focus on nurse suicide in over 20 years. So I started exploring it. And now I've published 10 papers on the subject, exploring the data in all different ways. I've got the entire longitudinal data set from the CDC that we keep looking at from different directions. Every time we find something new, a little thread in the data, we just explore it deeper. And every semester I get a new student, and we take another topic and just have at it with the data and go for it. So it's, and I don't think I could have had that liberty working in an academic environment because of the whole grant structure. Here in San Diego, none of our hospitals are like university hospitals attached to a school of nursing, you know, so any of us nurse scientists that work in the hospital environment, we're pretty free to follow our, what I say, follow our nose to the questions that arise from what's happening around us and explore them in the moment.
What would you say, I guess, outside of San Diego, where hospitals are attached to universities and academic or places of education, what would be the normal route for people in this field?
Well, first of all, I probably wouldn't be doing this because most of it is limited to people who are PhD prepared, and I have a doctor of nursing practice. I have the wrong degree for what I'm doing. So, and I just proceed until apprehended. And I never pretend that I've had the education that I don't have. And I usually construct my research teams wisely with people that have the skills I don't have. So round out the skills I don't have with a team member that has those skills. And I have very good mentors that answer my questions along the way. I do a lot of self-study. I didn't think it was, I didn't think I needed to go for two doctorates. So when I realized I had the wrong one, I just started self-study, self-made. Like when I do my qualitative research, I never had a course in qualitative research. So I just read as much qualitative research as I can in methodology papers and then study the methodology used by others and replicate it when I design my work. Then I bounce it off somebody that's an expert and say, hey, does this sound right to you or have I missed something? And a lot of experts in the field will feel honored when you call them. I did a study one time on blame in the workplace. There had never been a study on the consequences of being blamed for a patient outcome, but I knew it was causing distress amongst people when they got blamed, right?
Yeah.
So I thought that the distress caused by blame was probably somewhat related to moral distress, but moral distress is different because it's this distress caused by being prevented from doing something. And blame-related distress is a distress caused because you did something or somebody thinks you did something, right? So it's kind of a different construct, but I thought the actual distress might be the same. So I just out of the blue contacted Ann Hamrick, who has since passed on, bless her soul, but she was the matriarch of studying moral distress. She's published more on it than anybody in the world. So I just contacted her and I said, would you, you know, review my research plan for me? And I really need your advice. And she did. And she happened, believe it or not, she was in the East Coast and she happened to have a son that lived in San Diego. And when she came out to visit, we met for coffee at one of the local shops. And she and I talked for 2 hours and she gave me all this advice. And I'll tell you, I probably learned more than that in that 2 hours about the way I should construct the research than if I had taken a whole semester course, right? Yeah. I'm not bucking, like I've had 10 years of college education. I'm not saying don't go to college. That's not the answer, but you can learn, you can round out your skills by being thoughtful about the way you network and ask for advice and through mentors.
So it's kind of funny that you just say, I contacted so-and-so, but how do you get into contact with these people? How do you meet them? And how do you select the people that you consider your team?
Yeah, so being involved in professional organizations as a nurse will take you far. I've done a lot of work because of my involvement in AACN, American Association of Critical Care Nurses, and the Society of Critical Care Medicine. So whatever area of practice you belong in, it is essential to belong in an with the organization, and not just belong, but volunteer for committees. Because once people get to know that you'll be an active participant in committee work at the national level, they'll trust you to lead national initiatives. And that did happen to me through my career. I'm the first author on 2 different national guidelines for family-centered care. They were both, I picked the team by reading the research and picking the top researchers from around the world. I emailed them by the, when you have, there was 2 ways you could find their emails, either through the society, they were likely members, or to take the manuscript and look at the corresponding author, the lead author's, the corresponding author, and get the email off of the that. The third way to find their emails is you know where they work because the affiliation on their manuscript, their most recent manuscript, will show that they worked at University of Pittsburgh. So then you go to University of Pittsburgh faculty page and their emails are listed. So you can snoop down anybody. When I was constructing my theoretical model on facilitated sense making, one of the editors didn't want to publish it because she said, well, it's not been tested. You haven't tested it yet. Come back to me when you have results, whether this works or not. And I said to the editor, well, it's a theory. Once you test a theory, it becomes a fact, right? So this is a theory. So I called all the living theorists on a Sunday. I contacted them through email. I dug up, just like I said, how I found their emails. And I talked to Jean Watson, you know, Karen Theory. I talked to her over email on a Sunday afternoon, you know, did you have your grand theory tested before you published it? And she said to me, no, and I never have. She's never tested it. She said, people just believe it because it's so plausible. It just rings true to them. I've never tested it through research. And I had five theorists contact me back within an hour when I emailed them on a Sunday afternoon when I was constructing my theory and needed their advice. So the world is a smaller place than you would think. And usually people who have published are hams and they really enjoy when people reach out to them for advice. In fact, at UCSD right now, we're holding journal clubs and teaching other, like our research committee is teaching people how to do journal clubs on the unit level. And when we pick an article now, we're just inviting the author to present at our journal club. And we've been getting people to do it from around the country that, oh no, she'll never answer us. And sure enough, there she is. So it's really fun. Yeah.
One thing that I was wondering was, do you need to have any certifications before going into research or any requisites that you would
need? Yeah, you'll get a different answer depending on who you talk to about this, because many people that are PhD prepared do not think people like me should be allowed to do it without somebody that's PhD prepared on the, you know, team. And I actually have nurses that I work with that are conducting research with an associate's degree. So, you know, if you can, I mean, these are intelligent people. They're all college educated. And if you study hard enough, you know, you can be a self-made person and do some of these, and you have a good mentor. You must have a mentor, but you can pull it off without the formal academic degree, maybe not to the same level, not to the same degree, not with grant funding, but you can conduct research. At any level. But you do need to have training in ethical conduct of research. And so like every organization has a requirement to get through that committee approval for your research, you have to have training on file. And for instance, at UCSD, we use the National City Training. It's about a 4-hour module that you take online that teaches you about the ethics of conducting research. And you have to take all these little module quizzes. And once you get out the other end of that and can show your certificate, you can conduct research, right? Mm-hmm. It used to be at one time, and this is where nurses have a problem in some places, is that they would only allow faculty members to be the principal investigator, the top person on the research team. Faculty or some places even worse, only physicians. that is slowly eroding and going away. And those outdated rules happened because for a good reason, they were just rules about federal funding that were applied to all research instead of where they should have been applied only to federally funded research. They took these rules that were and applied them across the board. So there is a rule that to get federally funded monies for research, you have to have a faculty appointment. So you have to be in an academic environment with a faculty appointment to get an NIH grant. So that's a current rule, right? Mm-hmm. So I actually went and got a faculty appointment in the School of Medicine 3 years ago with the dream of someday doing a big grant funded project before I retired for the sole purpose of that. So that is a limitation. And all funding, whether it's federal or not, is often prioritize to PhD prepared people, so that if a DNP like me would be at lower priority than a PhD prepared nurse with the same, you know, qualifications. So that's a warning for people that are choosing their degree. The DNP degree is an excellent degree. I use everything I learned, but it's not really a degree for researchers. It's a degree for lead clinicians in a clinical environment.
Okay, yeah. I see. Then would you just suggest going for a PhD instead? And
if you're at the crossroads and you want to decide to go to what terminal, they call them terminal degrees, what terminal degree are you going to obtain? Is it going to be a PhD or a Doctor of Nursing Practice? If your focus is going to include research that relies on grant funding, or you would like to be tenure track professor in a school of nursing, get your PhD, right? If you want to stay in the clinical realm, the clinical environment, might do clinical instruction on the side, but you never care about being a tenure track faculty, that DNP is excellent for people who are remaining in what we call the service sector instead of academia, right? Mm-hmm. The service sector, meaning the clinical environment, yeah.
Yep. Okay. Yes. Thank you for clarifying.
Yeah. That's a common question. Yes. And usually DNP candidates, they have to do a project, a capstone project at the end that's not research. They do an evidence-based practice change project to bring in something new to an organization and change it, usually at a level higher than just the unit level, bring in a big practice change that's going to affect more than one department. Whereas PhD prepared people, their terminal project is a dissertation, mm-hmm. where they either have to publish 3 manuscripts based on the results of their research. The research has to be novel and bring some new knowledge to the profession, or they have to write the old fashioned big diatribe 100 page dissertation. Yeah.
Oh, that sounds so daunting.
Yeah. I don't know why some universities still haven't converted. Most universities have converted to the 3 manuscript system because there's no one that will ever read 100 pages of anything anymore.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Not only daunting to write it, but also daunting to read it.
It'll stick on a shelf. Nobody will ever read it. So why bother, right? Go straight to the short 15 page manuscripts that people might get something out of.
Yeah. So could you actually tell me more about what a day in your life looks like?
Okay, so nurses from all over the organization, they contact me, say, hey, my manager said you might be able to help me. I wanna go for my clinical advancement and become a CN3, right? Because we have a clinical ladder at UCSD. And so if they do a practice change project, they're involved in committees, they have good evaluations, right? And they're an expert clinical nurse, they can move up the ladder, get a raise and a promotion. But they have to do that change project, and their managers are often too busy managing to help them with that. So they'll send them over to me for a little guidance. And then they'll say, I've got this idea, but I don't know how to measure the outcomes. Like, how am I gonna set up the measurement, we call them measures of success. How am I gonna measure the success of this project? I know what I wanna do, but I don't know how to set up, like, how do I do that? And I'll work with them on, okay, so then we'll backtrack and I'll say, well, what got you interested in this anyway? What was the, are you trying to fix a problem, or did you find that we're doing something outdated? How did you start? And then they'll tell me about the problem that existed, and then we'll try to figure out measures that are targeted towards that problem. Did the problem go away after you changed the practice or improved the practice, right? Mm-hmm. So then we set up our measures of success that way. And then they don't, like, often nurses need to have help. How do you write a survey? How do you write test questions? How do you write the curriculum for teaching nurses about the practice change? You know, all of these things. How do you analyze the data? How do you make your graphs? How do you put them in a presentation? How do you use PowerPoint? How do you, it's like, it's all of that from soup to nuts. And what I try to do is find wherever this person is, like, where is the edge of their knowledge, and try to bring them one step past it, not like this, but one step past it, so they know that they've progressed while while performing that project, they can be quite proud of it and they've learned new skills along the way. Yeah. And then I often network people together. Today I had two nurses contact me. They want to do a project related to yoga. Well, 3 years ago in a whole different building, somebody else did a yoga project, right? So I connect the teams together so that they can learn from each other's best practices and obstacles that the first team went through that they can avoid. And, you know, if I had it to do over again, I would do this. So it's a lot of networking of people and getting them together. Then teaching classes along the way, little classes, sometimes about data, you know, those kind of things. I do my own research on suicide. And I've got two students now involved in that, who actually, one graduated and is still volunteering with me, and another one was supposed to leave me at the end of last semester, but she can't leave. she decided, she begged for another semester, so we're working together. Then I have a young gentleman who's pre-med on the research team. You asked me how these things happen, building the team, and he was interested in learning how to deal with big data. And I didn't know how to, I've got a big data set. And he had read a couple of my articles and he said, you know, I know you have access to this data set and it's restricted. Only faculty can get access to the data set through the CDC. So he said, can I join your research team so that I can do some machine learning with the data set and apply natural language processing to the death reports that are written by the medical examiners and the law enforcement agents when somebody dies. And I said, whoa, wouldn't that be fun? So we did. And now he's now on his fourth project with us, looking at the data from all different angles. And it's been lovely. Then I have my own mentor, Dr. Sid Zizek. He's a psychiatrist. I'm a critical care nurse and I'm studying suicide, right? So I don't have the depth of knowledge. I'm getting it over time, but I didn't start with the depth of knowledge about psychiatry. Psychiatric nursing and this whole issue of depression and suicide. So he's an expert, and we study physician data sometimes and nurse data other times. We go back and forth, and he keeps us grounded in the profession of psychiatry as to what some of these data findings mean, right? Like things like it's a preventable death if somebody had a gun in the home and a previous attempt and being treated for depression, because people, psychiatrists know if you get the gun out of the house, suicide is often an impulsive act. And if you get the gun out of the house and make it harder for somebody to kill themselves because the means is not there, then they often can bypass the impulse and reach out for help, and the situation can be salvaged, right? Mm-hmm. So that I wouldn't have known that tidbit, being a critical care nurse, unless I was working with a psychiatrist on the team, right? Yeah, yes. And then, yeah, a professor, Amanda Chauflet from San Diego State has joined the team this year. She has an expertise in substance use disorder. And she and I are doing some, she joined our team and we meet every 2 weeks. And she led us in a paper related to substance use disorder amongst nurses who have died by suicide, and that paper's in for review now. We're hoping it gets accepted soon. So she and I met because I'm an alumni, and Phil Greiner said, hey, I want you to meet this new professor. And that's kind of how it goes. And I said, oh, what are you interested in? And when she told me, I said, well, me too. And then we just started chatting, and whoa, so let's get together and do some work. And we have been really fun.
Oh my gosh, this is such a small world. It's really funny, I guess, hearing these names, because I'm like, oh, Professor Greiner, like, I know him. Yeah. Well, of course, because, but also Amanda Chauflet, she filmed a video in our skills lab, and I was actually a part of that. Yes. So I met her briefly. I didn't get to speak to her as long, but yeah, that's so funny.
There are probably 15,000 nurses in San Diego, and you'd think that it's a big place, like the 10th largest city in the United States, but we keep running into each other over and over again, and friendships that can last a lifetime.
Yes, exactly. Oh gosh. When you said her name, I was like, that sounds so familiar. Oh gosh. What, I was wondering, do you have any tips or words of advice for anyone listening in?
Definitely join a professional organization that's associated with your field of practice. I can't say enough about the opportunities that arise once you're connected that way outside of your own work environment. You can do a lot internally in your own work. You join a committee, you can make changes in the workplace, but if you want to really open your eyes to the possibilities of changing the profession as a whole, it takes years to lead up to that point where you're trusted to be able to make that kind of movement, but you need to be connected outside of the work environment to be able to do it. I'll give you one example if you'd like. Many nurses are upset about the Joint Commission standards for titration of medications, where they've changed in 2018, they changed it so that the doctor could no longer say titrate the dopamine to a blood pressure of 90. The doctor has to write the exact dose that you could titrate it by and how frequently you can do it. But doctors really can't predict how a patient's going to respond to medications, and they've never written orders that way. And pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics if you have one medication on board, but how many patients have one drug on board? Once you mix bunches of drugs together and the pH changes and fluid and electrolyte balances change and, you know, all of that, the size of the patient changes, that you can't predict how much medication they're going to need in the moment. And only nurses at the bedside can really see this and predict it. They make hundreds and thousands of decisions a day from titrating meds at the bedside of a critical care patient. So in any case, no one organization would be willing to go up against the Joint Commission and say, you know, this isn't working. You can't have a standard like this because their fear of retaliation, you know, because the Joint Commission accredits you. And they could make life difficult if they wanted to, not that they have to, but they could, right? So nobody's going to stand up against them as one organization. But if, I mean, like Sharp versus Cripps versus UCSD, but if it's the Society of Critical Care Medicine or the American Association of Critical Care Nurses representing all of critical care, right? If they go to the Joint Commission, hey, maybe something could be done. So what I did was there was a blog going on with nurses at the SCCM about how they can't meet these standards and they're jerry-rigging everything to try to make it work. And they found out nurses are falsifying records so they don't get in trouble for not meeting the standards. And they're just doing what the patient needs at the bedside, even though the doctor's orders say something else. And that's kind of against, you can lose your license for that. So I said, why are we, you know, the dog chasing the tail? Why don't we just do some research, get the data we need to demonstrate this doesn't work, and then go to the Joint Commission with it. So we did. There was 22 of us got together and we conducted research and turned in two different papers, a quantitative paper with over 900 responses from nurses about the practice and what it meant to them, and then a qualitative paper analyzing all of their open-ended comments for the distress that this caused them in the workplace. We sent them the first 90 results before we finished the project through the CEO of AACN, Connie Barden, chief officer of AACN. She went to the Joint Commission, met with Robert, the man's name is Robert, who wrote the standards, and let him know it wasn't really working for us. So they softened the standards mildly. They now allow us to do batch documentation instead of documenting every tiny little dose change. So that was like impossible as well. But now we're ready to meet with the Joint Commission again and hopefully take down the standards in their entirety. Based by doing this clinical research, getting the voice of the nurses documented in a way. We spent a few months preparing the survey, validating the survey correctly, and then sending in conducting the research, collecting the responses, analyzing it together, and then writing the papers and sending them in. Well, I'll tell you, this weekend I revised one of the papers, and the reviewer comment that came back to me from a nurse that reviewed the paper was, this is impossible. I questioned the veracity of this research because no one can conduct this kind of research that quickly. The investigators state they started in, you know, this month in 2020, and they did all the research and analyzed it, and they're turning it in now. That's impossible. And I wrote back to the reviewer. I said, miraculous. I said, and miraculous and unfunded. We had no money to do this. We did it totally by volunteerism, pooling together resources and skills of everybody that we knew that could help. And we got it done. So in any case, we're preparing now to go back to the Joint Commission, but this wouldn't have happened without participating in a professional organization at the national level. And you can make big change by doing that. Yeah, that's my biggest tip to people. And then always follow your nose. If you've got a clinical question, find a mentor and conduct your first study. Don't think it's reserved for only people with PhDs. Clinical nurses come up with the best questions to ask of the data and the best questions about what we might be doing better and differently.
They're right there. They're in the thick of it. So
yes.
Going back to what you said, as you were speaking, I was like, how long does research usually take? That was going to be my next question. And the fact that you've got people that banded together, found common passion, and that is amazing. But how long does research usually take?
At least a year. From soup to nuts, because you got to get it up. Even the approval process sometimes could take 2 to 3 months, depending on the complexity of the project and the risk. So if there's any potential risk of harm to the patient, and there is if you're testing new interventions at the bedside, right? I was just doing descriptive research. There's no risk there. Collecting survey data is not really risky. So it gets approved much faster. But when you're testing new techniques at the bedside, no one knows if they're really going to work or not. And those get scrutinized quite heavily to make sure we're not putting people at undue risk. So that approval process could take several months. Yeah. And then you gotta first do your lit review, make your research plan. So there's a month, then a few months in review, right? And then you get it approved. And then you have to start the work, collect your data, and analyze the data and write the report. So it's months. It usually adds up to at least a year.
Wow.
Yeah.
My goodness.
Yeah. But it's fun. And 1 year rolls into the next, and before you know it, you've got a bunch of them under your belt, and you could be proud of the things you've done along the way.
I know. This isn't really something that we talk about in nursing school. Yeah, so I think
it's important to start there. You need your clinical underpinnings to be able to do some of the other work, right? Or even to generate the questions to ask for research. So,
especially in this field.
The nursing school, the curriculum is so tight, you can barely fit everything in. I'm sure that in nursing school, everyone says to themselves, why didn't they teach me this when they get out into the real world? Because there is so much to teach and so little time in class. So these kind of, the research is touched upon briefly. Of course, that you're encouraged to read research when you're in school so that that's your exposure to it. And then conducting research, you just need to, once you start generating those questions in your head about why aren't we doing this differently, find a mentor and get started.
Well, thank you again.
Hi, thank you again for listening. And I apologize for not posting in a minute, but tune in later in April for the next episode. So see you then.
This was very insightful, and I feel like I learned a lot from this, and I hope that everyone listening can take away just as much.